In this episode of the Well-Traveled Wellness Podcast, we interview Lachlan Wilmot of the Greater Western Sydney Giants of the Aussie Rules Football League. Lachlan and I discuss match week programming, how to develop running power, and the origins of Quidditch. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to the Well-Traveled Wellness Podcast. Maximum performance, minimum fun. Critical wisdom and actionable insights from leading minds in the field of human performance around the globe. And now, here's your host, Jake George Schuster.
And power coach at the Aussie Football League's Sydney Giants. We managed to call across the Tasman to a sport that is very different from rugby, very different from NFL, but pretty incredible and unique in its own right, and I'm excited to learn more about it today. So welcome to the show, Lachlan.
Thanks, Jake. Thanks for having me on, mate. It's good to find some time for it.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. Now, I think we should have the most important question first, which is, do you think that J.K. Rowling stole Quidditch from AFL?
Mate, there is it is funny. I've tried to explain AFL to people before Harry Potter comes out, and now that it's come out, I think it's much easier to explain it as just Quidditch with a little bit of differences. So my girlfriend's American and she definitely relates it to Quidditch, so I think she has stolen a few aspects of it, definitely.
It's good to get that confirmation. I've really forced myself to watch more lately, and pardon in research for this interview, and you just watched and you said, wow, this is Quidditch. It's humans playing Quidditch in real life.
It is, mate. It is. It's it gets stemmed to being very much like a bunch of seagulls chasing a chip. They're very fit seagulls, put it that way.
Yeah, I like how, I mean, any sport you just don't get it until you get it, and all the different contexts and the things you don't see until you have them pointed out. I have to say, I think AFL is the strongest example of that. Rugby, you look at it at first, especially as an American, see a bunch of guys running into each other and falling over, and then you get to learn it and you say, well, this is way more complex and subtle and nuanced than American football. Mm. But AFL, at first, when you watch it, that's exactly what it looks like, a bunch of seagulls. Oh.
It is. And the weakness and drawback with AFL is it's not designed for television. It's when you watch it on television, if you understand the game, it's exciting, you love to watch it, but there's so many things that occur off the ball, out of view, down in one end, that you don't really understand until you go to a game. And for anyone who's been to a game, knowing the size of the field, like it's the size of a cricket field, which is a fairly large oval. So it's very hard on television to try and capture everything that's going on. So probably you don't really understand the nuances of it until you're actually at a game, which is why it's such an impressive spectacle when people finally get themselves to a live game.
I have a Dutch friend who spent a year out in Melbourne, and he's helped run the Australian Opens. He's been at Champions League finals. He's been at a lot of stuff, and he said that watching a match in the Melbourne Cricket Oval was the most spectacular thing he's ever seen.
Yeah, the MCG is a mecca of sport, mate. It's an unbelievable area, and 100,000 people crammed in to watch an Anzac Day game or a grand final is nothing more amazing, mate, in my opinion.
Now, what for people who are still probably YouTubing this as they listen, Lachlan, what are the unique things which AFL athletes need in their toolkit?
Look, I think bottom line, doesn't matter how you slice it, it's an aerobic sport. People love to, especially me being a strength and power coach, I put a lot of emphasis and a lot of importance on strength and power within our players, because I think it is definitely there, the sharper edge of their swords, but your base and everything that they need is running power. If our boys can't run out what is effectively four quarters of half an hour, so 2 hours worth of running, that's spread over 3 hours. So from, bounce down to the final siren, that's 3 hours of work that they're switched on for, whether it be half time, they're still obviously getting a bit of a rest, but their systems are still jacked. So at the end of the day, they need to have that aerobic running capacity to be able to run out the game. But on the other side, if they don't have the speed, the strength, and the actual physicality to be able to take hits, they're not going to be able to utilize that aerobic running power that they may have gotten in the preseason. So what we find is when we get young athletes in, they're usually very talented in regards to their running capacity. That's usually what sets them apart in their youth leagues. We obviously get some of our key positions that are quite large and strong athletes, but generally the number one, twos and three draft picks that come in can have that running capacity. But the problem is when they get into an AFL level, they get hit so often, they've got so much faster requirements when it comes to breakouts and things they need to do, that their aerobic power that they had as a junior suddenly becomes a little bit hampered within the game. So so it's something that we obviously need to build with them as they come in. That no one's ever ready built when it comes to aerobic power. But the most important thing is we need to put some size on them. We need to put some speed into them. We need to put some strength into them. But all of that needs to be done while keeping or improving their aerobic power. So I think sometimes what the hardest thing is you know, they come in fit and really explosive when they do it, but we try and put on that size, we try and put on that strength, and some people tend to lose that aerobic side. So it is a little bit of a balancing act of trying to build them up whilst trying to keep that aerobic side to them, which I reckon is probably one of the bigger challenges we have.
Yeah, you see these athletes, and I mean, I think it's great that you said it's an aerobic sport right off the bat, Lachlan, because when you look at these guys, it's almost like they have upper bodies of, I don't want to say soccer athletes, because that might sound almost derogatory to combat sport athletes, but you know, they look like almost Cristiano Ronaldo, you know, one of those big beefy guys in the upper body, but the lower body, they could be rugby sevens players. You know, they've got muscular and you can handle hits. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just saying that's 100% correct. We often get players looking like that in the fact that, you know, if a great example is our midfielders. So our midfielders are, anywhere between 183 centimetres up to some of them up to about 190 centimetres, but usually in that 183 to 189, 88 area. And they usually weigh approximately, 84 kilos into that 89 kilos. So if they come in and they're sitting at that, say, let's take a 185 centimetre. So for American style, let's say, a touch above 6 foot, maybe 6'1", mm-hmm. and they're weighing in, at 93 kilos, suddenly this extra weight that they're carrying, that they just physically can't run out a game with that type of load on them.
Right.
So we find that our boys, that especially when they get to their target weight, that if they're going 1 kilo or 2 kilo heavier, even if it's due to hydration, they will report it and they tend to feel it, whether it be in their groin, hip, whatever it might be, especially with the style of grounds. Like we have some grounds that are softer, some grounds that are harder. So when we play on a harder ground, we get noticeable difference. When we play on a softer ground, we get a noticeable difference. So they're very sensitive athletes when it comes to minute changes, whether that be ground hardness or their actual body weight. So it's something that we put a huge focus on. It's not, we don't have that that typical, preseason where our first block is hypertrophy. In our program or in my programming, when we put it into the gym, hypertrophy is that satellite requirement that some players may have. But it is definitely not a block that we go through, because realistically, if we have a fourth or a fifth year player, excluding our rucks, and our rucks are our really tall guys, they take a little bit longer to get going. But our main group, if they're in their fourth or fifth year and they're still requiring a hypertrophy program, then something's gone wrong somewhere.
Right.
Because they should be at their target weight, and a target playing weight is what we focus on a lot. We never just keep trying to get players bigger, because they're almost, they have that aspect of almost boxing style athletes where they have their ideal body weight. They have their competitive weight that both balances their strength and power, but also balances their running capacity. And if we start to push them up and start to put more mass on them, suddenly something else is sacrificed.
You know, it sounds like this might be one of the finest examples of a demand for concurrent training, because there's only so much you can accomplish in a week, especially when recovery and match preparation becomes a factor. How do you balance all of these needs for the athlete into a training program?
With great challenges. It's funny. I think a lot of people from the outside view, so I'll use the term high performance sport, as this ideal world. And in actual fact, it is almost the opposite.
Yeah, that's hysterical if people think that.
Yes, it's like, you know, when you're a strength and conditioning coach that's working, say, with an amateur team or a local grassroots team, and you're struggling to find time to do this, struggling to find a gym to do that, and you see a professional team, you think, oh, it'd be so great to have their environment, to be able to, you know, have all the stuff that they have and be able to get the most out of our players. Now, I'm not saying that professional environments don't have a lot more access to things. They definitely do. But they also come with a lot of challenges that aren't faced in amateur leagues as well. So for one of our examples is our boys, due to their players association agreement, they have to have 2 massages a week. So unfortunately, that is one of the hardest things for us to program into our schedule when we have a limited time within the day, because the old story is, when do you fit it in? And we've tried to tinkle around with the best way to do it. But yeah, ultimately, sometimes it occurs that they'll have massage and then they'll come into weights.
Well,
is that ideal?
If they have limitations, you're you know, pun intended, you're a bit hamstrung by that scheduling, aren't you?
Without a doubt, without a doubt. So we do have to be quite flexible and move around that. So often our scheduling is the first thing. So we need to schedule in, well, from the first go is the head coach, what he wants from a on-field point of view, also from a skills point of view. And then we need to work out where are we going to put in the massage. And then that pretty much leaves us with where we can fit everything else. So at the end of the day, we are on field, that is our priority work. So we usually do our on-field stuff first in the day, and then we do our strength training in the afternoon. But the idea behind trying to balance everything and get the most out of it is it is very tough. So from our point of view, we need to separate our group into players that have specific requirements. So those boys that have, you know, if they're a younger player, they might be a key position player that's in their second or third year that isn't to body weight, then they do have a priority around hypertrophy. And in doing that, we need to try and make sure that we can get enough stimulus into them to create some sort of hypertrophy response whilst they're still running, because the last thing we want to do is hypertrophy them and then they lose some running capacity and the head coach then can no longer utilize them for whatever he wants to do tactically. So from our point of view, it's not about pulling them out of their running side of things, which can be quite tough at times. It's about finding extra times where we can try and get a little bit more stimulus into them. So what we tend to do is we try and grab that group, and we might do morning sessions when it comes to weights, and we might do upper body work in the morning, then they'll go on field, and then they'll do their lower body work in the afternoon. So it's not about taking away the bit of the pie that is the running side of it. It's about trying to find time in their days and their week where we can actually fit more training to be more specific with them. And you've got to be smart about it, because there's no point us doing a large squat session in the morning and then sending them on field and they run 10 to 11Ks.
Right.
And maybe, you know, 600, 500 meters of that is high speed meter. So it can be very challenging. But I think we do it quite well in the fact that we identify who needs what, and then we set them up for success, because there's no point having 3 weight sessions in a week and telling all the players they're doing 3 weight sessions and then having, say, 10% of your list that need to get significantly stronger, but they're still doing the same amount of volume as the players that are looking to, we'll use the word maintain. I'm not a massive fan of maintain, but those boys that need to hold their weight. So we definitely try and individualize the week to allow those boys that need to get bigger or stronger the opportunity to set them up for success. Because at the end of the day, if we demand it from them, we need to be able to give them the opportunity to do it. So in our preseason schedule, we can have some players doing upwards of 5 different weight sessions within the week, and other boys that'll be doing 3, others that might do 2 with a mobility and a robustness style program. So it does fluctuate a lot when it comes to our in-gym work in that instance. And then on field, obviously all players will do the group work, but then we'll start to bring their conditioning in. So our conditioning coach, Andrew Barnett, and then obviously David Joyce, our high performance manager, will look at what players need, what extras, and then they'll start to individualize them for boys that need more speed work, boys that need some longer running, and then they'll tend to do that within the actual on-field session.
Okay. And then what about creation and maintenance of explosive capacities, Lachlan. So I think about, you know, sprinting and in rugby, you know, your rucks, and probably in AFL, your jumping ability, and all of these kind of explosive skill sets which are needed in these sports. How do you balance working on those and creating and maintaining those while continuing to work on capacities and the engine, as you speak about, and maintaining weight, you know, while fitting all of this in?
Yes. Yeah. So it's at the end of the day, we try and, as you said, that concurrent side of things where we really have an aspect of everything all the time. So there's never a time where we're not doing any explosive work. It's just going to be the percentage that our program's committed to that. So
okay.
In the early preseason, we will, for a majority of players, we will chase their maximum strength side of things to try and boost their strength up after they've come back off the off season. Some players will get to their targets quicker than others. So usually that will be our older players, our more senior players. Once they hit their strength requirements where we need them to be, because we're a firm believer in the fact that strength is the underlying quality to power. If our boys aren't strong enough, then there's no point trying to chase that explosive side of it, because they've just got nothing as that groundwork.
Right.
So our older players will usually get there quicker, in which case their percentage of their program will become more explosive. So that'll be more plyometric and jump work. They'll start to look at, you know, bar velocity work a little bit more. And their programs, their actual gym programs, will start to get a little bit shorter and have that more intensification side. Whereas our younger players will maintain that sort of accumulation period for a little bit longer, and also look to chase some more max strength, and we'll start to hunt their targets. Some players get to where we want them, you know, maybe a week after or 2 weeks after. Some players take till after Christmas. Now we start beginning of November, usually around that time. So we'll have sort of a 2 month, maybe 6 week block before Christmas. And then we go into approximately a 6 week block after Christmas. So within that 12 weeks, we will have boys drifting out of their accumulation and intensification work into their explosive work. Some earlier than others. But the idea is from day one, they will be doing some sort of plyo or jump work, whether that be, you know, 2 to 3 sets at the beginning of the session. And the others, you know, our senior boys might be doing some maximal squat work with some contrasted plyometric work. So I suppose the simplest way to answer a complex question is every player has strength requirements. Once they hit those strength requirements, that defines where they go with their plyo and jump work. And that will then define how we go with it in the afternoon. So it's a tough one, because it's not like we look at a player and go, right, they need to be more explosive, therefore we're going to change their on-field work, because they still need to have the capacity to do everything on field. So we keep their on-field requirement. But if it is a direct acceleration target we need, then we'll probably attack more of that in the gym. But if it's more of a max velocity work, then we'll tend to attack it both on field, and that might be before or after training with some speed work, but they'll also get some top-up work in the gym. I hope that makes a bit of sense.
It does. It totally does, Lachlan. And I think your answer in a good way highlighted that it's complicated. I think most things in our field are much simpler than people make it out to be. This one is probably not.
I think the simplest way to put it as well is, I think people look at it and go, oh, if someone needs more explosive work, do we need to pull back on this, start to accelerate on this, change that? In our world, we don't have the capacity to be able to pull a key player out of a tactical game that might be done on field.
Right.
So, you know, if they're at risk, we definitely can. And if we really sell something, we can. But we have a, you know, our rule is we want to make our players available for our coaches. So we're there to make sure our players are on field learning everything they need to learn so they can play as best as they can. If we're pulling players out of tactical things for them to get, you know, half a second quicker here and there, then it's very hard for us to justify that to the coaches. Because at the end of the day, in our sport, is a player that can take one step earlier better than a player that can kick more accurately? Definitely not. At the end of the day, it's the skill side of thing that'll win it for our sport. So we make our players available, or we give training sessions back to the coaches. That's our number one goal. So we base everything we do off that. So that, from our point of view, means that we do not want to change on-field work. when it comes to actually pulling players out. If it means we have to shorten drills, lengthen drills, change some dimensions, talk to the coaches around that, and if they're happy to do that, that's fine. But we have to have our players out there all working together, doing all of their drills. So when we try and find extras for our boys and find, you know, whether it be a little bit more explosive work, that will be done externally. So that might be done in the warm-up, might be done before training, might be done after training, or the biggest fluctuation will be in the gym, because obviously that is where our coaches, you know, it's a, you know, all us, the coaches don't do tactical things in the gym. So we can have the freedom to be able to say, right, your strength target's fantastic. Let's work on your explosiveness and start doing a little bit more work around that in the gym. Make it shorter, make it sharper, whatever it needs to be done. But at the end of the day, we do the best we can not to touch or interfere with anything on field, except give our recommendations, obviously, around loading. But we definitely don't try and change what they do on the field.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And what do you say for an actionable example for the listeners, Lachlan? Would you say something like, rather than trying to add in or take away sessions, that, you know, you'd give them one fewer set of a heavy lower body lift, and you know, so that you have the time to superset it with some kind of jump and that type of thing to get in an extra stimulus?
Without a doubt. Contrast training we use quite a bit. I think there's a lot of value to doing our standalone pliers as well, but there's no doubt that we do blocks of contrast work where they'll look for that post-activation potentiation, whether you believe it to be instantaneous in some contrast work or that 3 to 5 minute recommendation. At the end of the day, I think you lift something heavy, then you be explosive. We can get some good response from that.
I think the skill set and the motor learning carryover is probably worth it, whatever the physiology is.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Yeah, no, I'm glad to have asked you about that, Lachlan, because I find myself, you know, programming here with the sevens, you know, sometimes the team will empty the tank in the weight room in the morning and then they'll come out for a speed session. I say, neurally, you know, do they have anything left for this? Is this session for me or is it for them? You know,
that is 100% correct. And I think we do that a lot with our, you know, I'm a massive believer, and I've said it a few times, that we build frameworks and then we adjust from there. People that, I think team sports are so hard to have this specific intensity or volume requirement for that day, because so many individuals respond differently. And on top of that, coaches change things all the time. So, you know, pre-season, we can, you know, our coaches are pretty good with it. So I must admit we're pretty lucky. But, you know, there might be an allocated hour and a half session and that turns into a two-hour session. So, you know, when I programmed, you know, 2 weeks prior to that for this block, did I account for that? No. So what do I need to do? I need to adjust things in the gym. So if I've had this hard and fast, this is what we're going to do, this is where we're going to go with it, because this is what I programmed, this is what the block needs to be, then you're just going to start losing players and you're going to start breaking players. So you need to have that flexibility of, this is the framework I'm going with for this block, but I know that things are going to change. So we, you know, we definitely make sure that that things are planned and frameworked, but it's very flexible.
I think the point you've made there needs to be reiterated, in that, you know, we don't have to look far at Leicester City winning the Premier League now and you know, all the stats they've been showing about how they had the fewest lineup changes in history and, you know, the injuries and all that. I don't know the guy, but I'd wager that, you know, the coach is pretty happy with the strength and conditioner at the end of the year.
Yes, definitely, definitely. And it's, you know, like I said, Joycey says it all the time, you know, our goal as a department is to give training days back to the coaches. You look at the AFL, you know, I would imagine this stat would go across every sport, but AFL has clearly found statistically that the highest ranked teams, so those teams that are finishing at the top of the ladder, have the least game-to-game changes. Simple as that. They play their number one side more often, which makes sense. Like, I mean, it's not rocket science. It's, you know, you could barely call it sports science. It's just common sense that if you have your best players playing and you have that fixed team week to week, you're going to perform at your greatest. So our idea, you know, everything we do, everything we plan is to basically bring our team ready to go week to week. And we try and, you know, we try and produce our number one team every week. It doesn't always happen, obviously. But I think if you plan everything and set up your frameworks based off that, I think you're doing a pretty good job.
Yeah, I think then what needs to happen next for our industry is that we make it sexy for that to be our priority.
Yes. Yeah.
Then it's the exercises and crazy stats about, you know, 10 meter times or something like that.
Yeah, I was in Seattle a couple of months ago and caught up with Patrick Ward, who's at the Seattle Seahawks, and he said that now I don't know if it's his saying or if he's taken it off someone else, but he says the best ability is availability, and that has stuck in my head like nothing else, because it's a great line, and it's a great almost mantra to have, because I think a lot of people chase things and they start to forget that, you know, there's players out there that I call them the anti-sports science players, and as much as I hate them, I love them. I love these guys that you look at them and like their shoulder mobility is horrific. Their hips have never gone past 90 degrees in the past decade. They're rounded. They shuffle around. They have terrible running technique. Their skin folds aren't great. They tend to eat what they want, but on the field, they are unbelievable. And every sports science law says that these guys should not be turning up week to week playing the way they do, but they do. So I think at the end of the day, you've got to sit back and say, look, you know, we are here to compliment them and compliment the players and the coaches. And at the end of the day, it is a skill-based sport for a lot of it. And some of these highly skilled players can get through their games without needing the high-end sports science that we often talk about. That doesn't mean we don't do the best we can, because we all know that, you know, they're going to be more and more likely an injury. Just because they get through a year without being injured, it doesn't mean that everything's perfect. But I think it's sort of tries to, I think it humbles you a little bit and just says, look, just sit back and say, you know, sports science and strength and conditioning and everything around that isn't the most important thing. You know, at the end of the day, you're an accessory to everything. And I think that's how you got to act.
Yeah. That's pretty well said. Actually, I don't have anything to add to that, mate. And that's perfect. I think the more us practitioners in the industry just kind of chill out and try to do well by the athlete, the better off we'll be, the happier we'll be, and the more our athletes will like us. And I think we would all benefit from all three of those, wouldn't we?
Exactly. And it's about progress, isn't it? You know, if we've been in team sport, we all know that there's an echelon of players that sit there and they'll do everything under the sun. And you know that you can tell them anything and they're going to do anything for you. They'll run through the wall for you. So those boys, you're still looking to progress. So where are you going to progress them? You're going to progress them in a very elite level. You're really going to go the high end work with them. But then you've got some players, you know, at the bottom side of it that wake up and have a Pop-Tart for breakfast. So you're like, well, where are we going to take you? Maybe we're not going to take you down to this extreme route, but what progress can we make with you? So at the end of the day, it doesn't matter where your player sits on that realm of, you know, sports science or that commitment to athleticism, you've still got to progress them. So if you've got a player that's never done weights before, what's the goal? Let's start them doing some strength work. Let's get them used to being strong. Let's get them used to having some injury resilience. But a player that's done weights for a decade, what's their goal? You know, they might be going a little bit more in their elite side of strength training. So I think you've really got to make sure that you're across your athletes and know how far you can push them, because you can't push all your athletes equally. You've got to progress them all, but they're all going to progress at different rates.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Well-Traveled Wellness Podcast. If you leave a review on iTunes, you'll get a free coaching session with me. Check back next week for an interview with Dr. Lane Martin.
To learn more about how you can achieve maximum performance with minimum fuss, sign up to our free newsletter at welltraveledwellness.com. You'll get actionable insights from real people on how they manage their days to lead ultra-healthy and productive lifestyles. Sign up today at welltraveledwellness.com.